Hello and welcome to Rule of Carnage. This is a series of conversations between Glenn Ford, a games designer, and me, Mike Hutchinson, also a games designer, on the many and varied rainbow of topics that we call designing better miniature games. And we talk about designing better miniature games, although Glenn does design some games that aren't miniature games. I don't tend to. But therein, that little subheading is sort of the topic that I'm heading in the direction of with this rambling preamble, which is sometimes you can make a miniature game and sometimes you can come up with an idea that might not be a miniature game or might not best be expressed as a miniature game. And I guess Glennon quite explicitly goes through a process where he has an idea and goes, oh, what about this game? And then he looks it in the face and goes, are you a miniature game? Do you really need miniatures? Whereas I tend to back into this in a slightly different way where I go, ooh, miniatures! What are all the things that I can do with them? And the question, should this be a miniatures game, has barely ever occurred to me. And given that level of rigor in my thinking, Glenn was writing a piece of writing recently to address the this question that keeps coming up, which is, hey, I've got this idea for a game. Is this a good idea for a game? And the idea might be, well, actually, there's some things in this idea that suit a card game better or a board game better or, you know, a live action role playing game as an expression of this core idea. So Glenn's got some specific areas that he thinks are worth consideration when you're thinking about whether something is good for a miniatures game. And individually, each one of them sounds sane and logical, and I don't understand them. And so I thought it would be lovely to have a series of conversations where through Socratic discourse, I discover what it is that Glenn means by these things. And hopefully my ignorance will be illuminated and thus yours as the audience member simultaneously. And that will be content.
Splendid. Yes.
So I think we should probably just preface this by saying, for the purposes of this conversation, we believe that there are like two core affordances of miniature games, the kinds of miniature games that we make. And one of them is that they're obsessed with spatial relationships between markers and the absolute distance and the relative positioning of them. And when we say markers, those can be, you know, miniatures, or they can be the scale terrain and buildings and whatnot. But the game is obsessed with the spatial relationships. And so there's a very specific core affordance here, which is, well, given that we're obsessed with those things and we give players tools to measure them and adjudicate them, then you can create very complicated physical situations and physical relationships. And that's the first. And the second is that these games that we talk about can accommodate an enormous diversity of physical objects in a way that's almost unlike any other game. So if we're playing Warhammer 40,000 and we put a shoe on the table, perhaps not a cat, maybe that bucks the trend, but a shoe, we can easily just say, well, let's just count that as obscuring terrain for now. Mm-hmm. And the game will willingly accept and accommodate the vast diversity.
Yeah. Whereas conversely, and it's a sort of reverse definition in a way, because if you're playing Monopoly and you stick a shoe onto the board, the game itself has no concept of how to engage with that object. It's an order of idea that can't even begin to be grasped by it. And I think those are certainly some things that these sorts of games do that other games can't do, and that these sorts of games are interested in. But I think one thing that has popped up certainly a few times recently in like the Discord and various conversations, which might be getting towards where there's a sort of borderline thing, is like single model combat tabletop games. Like particularly, there's certainly a rise at the moment in like 75mm scale minis, and there are quite a few people going, ah, there's all these amazing 75mm scale minis, we should totally be able to do a game with them. Oh, I'll do a game where each person's only got one mini. And very quickly it gets to a place of where like it's incredibly hard to make the spatial relationship interesting then. And what you often end up with somebody is going, well, we'll get these two minis together and then it will be about like where you're hitting, and I'll represent where you're hitting with cards and counters and tokens. And then after a little while, it's just like, it's just not a minis game at that point. It's what it's there's a little bit of preamble of moving them in his round, and then it's just a cards and counters game, and you should just make a cards and counters game.
Right, because the central relationship between the two models has ceased to be important or relevant, really, to the game.
Yeah, it's super hard to make a one mini per side.
Unless you have posable arms and you can only move your arm a certain number of centimetres.
Well, I mean, this is the thing, and this is one of the things that's super hard, particularly about, like, human skirmishing minis with one model per side, particularly if it's a combat-based game. You know, it's like, well, okay, we've both got guns. You want to draw a bead on me, so you move around and then get line of sight on me. No matter where you've gone, whatever you've done, what I then do is go, well, pivot. There we go. Now our relationship is completely, like, relationally the same. I just pivot on the spot. I don't even need to move. Mm. And to keep that interesting when you can so easily, you know, because me seeing you and you seeing me is, like, relationally identical, it's incredibly hard to make that interesting and useful and work as a minis game. But yeah, as you said, I've sort of broken down some of the other things that I think are an indicator as to why you might not want to make a minis game or why you might want to make a board game. And I think you've got, like, some of them in a list, and we might talk about one of them in this conversation and then move on to some of the others.
Yeah, that sounds right. That sounds right. So let's hit skills and abstraction. So this is thinking about what you might wish to abstract what you might wish to simulate, and where there are potentially transferable or non-transferable skills, and how all that bears on the decision about whether this is it or is not best expressed as a miniature game.
Yeah. And this is, I think, less of a sort of dividing line, you know, that you straddle one way or the other, and more a sort of principle of guidance, maybe. So whenever you make it, I think that whenever you make a game, there are some skills of the player that you are trying to test with that game, and some other skills that you're going to abstract out or drop off or that you're not really just that interested in. So, for example, the game of snooker, the sport of snooker, has a lot of specific skills to do with, like, how you use a cue and how you screw a ball back and all those sorts of things. And it also has judging angles, which is like a transferable human skill. Like, well, if I hit that thing at a certain angle, it will bounce off another angle, you know, or just aiming at a thing. And it also has a skill of, like, strategy within snooker, where you're like, oh, well, I want to leave the cue ball behind that ball so he can't then get to that other ball. And so there's sort of three general areas. There's the specific snooker skills of how you handle a cue, the sort of dexterity game.
Right, the physical skills that you've developed.
Yeah, there's the transferable skills of judging angles and, you know, just physically aiming. And then there's the strategic skills that kind of aren't transferable, because, like, whether or not it's a good idea to leave a cue ball behind, you know, a black ball isn't a strategic judgment that is transferable to many other things. And then there are various games that have recreated snooker, like on the tabletop and in computer games, and they tend to, by necessity, abstract out the screwing a ball back, you know, the way you maneuver a cue and all those sorts of things. Like, there's tons of computer games, digital games, that definitely have the judgment of angles, definitely have aiming, definitely have strategy, and then you, like, press a button to make it so that the ball screws back.
So if we change the example to soccer,
sure,
for the purposes of having access to, like, Sabutio, and so clearly flicking a little Sabutio, what Weeble Wobble Man, isn't the same physical skill as kicking the ball on the field, but potentially, like, where to position my players at a given point in the game's evolution, or, like, what the angle that is going to be able to hit the goal. Like, obviously the ball is a different size and weight and stuff, but, like, there's enough physical analog that maybe some of those transferable skills for angles and stuff might be relevant in Sabutio as they are in striking on a goal in the park.
Yeah, and so generally for games, like assuming that the game you're making is recreating some form of a reality, even if it's fantasy, sci-fi reality, then there is presumably going to be a protagonist within your game, and the protagonist is presumably going to be evidencing certain skills throughout the passage of the game. And I think that deciding whether or not the skills you want them to evidence are, the literal skills that the protagonist is evidencing. And those are going to have to be transferable skills because you are not going to put the player in the literal situation of the protagonist. Which of those skills you're going to abstract out, how you are then going to abstract them out, goes a long way towards guiding you, I think, in whether or not you're going to design a miniatures game. So, for example, I've spoken a few times about how, like, one of the things that's interesting about miniatures games is that a great general, and I think the reason that like miniatures games of simulation are miniatures games, is that we have an idea that a great general stands literally on a hill above a battlefield, like, Waterloo Wellington literally was sat within eyesight of the battlefield on a horse, and looks at the positions of the various men and judges who can move to a certain direction, who can get to a certain place before they're intercepted, who can overpower somebody else by looking at the battlefield and judging the flow of battle. And a lot of the time, that is the thing we are kind of trying to recreate with a tabletop miniatures game. And so then the sort of the transferable skills of judging distances and movement rates and sort of empathically putting yourself into someone's position and figuring out what they can or can't see, like the Charge of the Light Brigade, is a famous historic instance where a general said to pass a message to somebody something based upon the fact that the general could see something that the guy receiving the message couldn't, and that was a blunder of a general that he was unable to sort of transfer his consciousness into what his men could see before telling them something. And I think that if those sorts of skills about sort of being able to like transfer your consciousness around to different places, being able to judge whether somebody can see something from a place separate from yourself, being able to judge movement rates and sort of the relationships of spaces, on the tabletop. If those are the transferable skills you're interested in, then super easy choice. You want to be making a minis game. And then if the things you want to abstract are the things about how a bloke hits another bloke with a sword, and you're happy to put that into a dice roll or the flip of a card or something like that. Yes, again, miniatures games, absolutely brilliant. Now, if you want that sword play to be less abstracted, and obviously, not obviously, but probably you're not going to ask your players to start whacking each other in the face with swords. Although, if you're writing a live action role playing game, maybe you are. But maybe you're like, okay, well, I don't want to actually get them to hit each other with swords, but there is a bluff and sort of judgment and involved within a sword fight. Maybe I want to create some sort of bluffing mechanism within my game. Well, how am I going to do that? Am I going to use certain like components? And this is where you start looking at something like X-Wing, where with its little dials and its bits and pieces and its extra lovely splendidness, which means it has to be more of a packaged game. And then like
But at the same time, that game feels like it's about making judgments as the pilot in a spaceship that may or may not get through that gap between the X-wing and the enemy, between the asteroid and the enemy fighter. And so, like,
Yeah, absolutely.
you're still testing, as you're saying, like, you're still testing something in the area of that, like judging distance, judging movement rates, transferring the sort of perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that X-Wing is definitely still a minis game, but it's sort of starting down that path into where there's some more things that are less abstracted and are more sort of product heavy. And then, like, if what you are interested in the battle game or the fight, like I say, if we go back to that single miniatures game, you're not really interested in the movement of the minis and their relationship and whether they can see each other. You're interested much more in, you know, okay, I'm either going to go for a high stance or a low stance, and you're going to try and either duck or jump. And it's like, well, the minis aren't doing any of those things. And you're representing all of those things, all of the meat of the game, all the things you're interested in, the bluffing and the exchange, you're going to be representing with cards and tokens and non-mini things. The whole game is going to be played sort of away from the minis. And I think sometimes we're sort of like, okay, well, what I want to do is I want to simulate a bunch of guys like shooting at and fighting a bunch of other guys. Probably it's a minis game, minis war game. I just get on designing a minis war game. And sometimes, you know, I've looked at some prototype games and it's like, it feels like what you're interested in here is a quite abstract relationship between like a monster and a human, where, you know, the human's getting scared and the monster's chasing them. And like, well, the chasing and the running away bit on the tabletop is a little bit sort of rudimentary. Not the monster always moves towards them, they always move away, the monster moves towards them, they always move away. But whenever the monster moves towards them, it uses a special scare ability, and the human is using a certain sort of hiding, etc. And it's like, well, the interesting bit are these slightly abstracted things that are the relationship between them. That would be just much smoother and simpler, you know, as a card game where you're picking the different attacks the monster is making. You know, if there isn't crunch and interest and play within the physical relationship of the things on the tabletop, a lot, you know, surprisingly often, I think sometimes in these games, the physical movement of minis around the tabletop is quite quite rudimentary and quite sort of like the bit you're least paying attention to. It's like, I absolutely...
And that's, you're not saying there that like movement rules have to be complicated, but simply that they have to be meaningful, or the position that you move them into has to be super meaningful.
Absolutely. I don't believe that complexity gives like meaning. I think that, like, you know, you can have a handful of markers moved in an incredibly simple way around the tabletop. And the beauty, I think, of tabletop miniatures games, because they're non-discreet relationship, is that really simple rules could describe incredibly complex situations, because there's like an infinite, you know, range of spaces and differences. You know, I mean, Puke Apocalypse is basically about like, put two things roughly a certain distance together, guess whether or not a handful of chips will span the space between them. And it's like, that's super simple, but it's like, I don't know if I can eyeball whether these chips will do that spread. You know, it is inherently quite an interesting thing, and like, where can I move to be able to put the chips in the places that I want them to go. And so I think, like, a lot of the time, I mean, not a lot of the time, but some of the time, I see minis games and I sort of feel like you're not really that interested in what is happening on the tabletop. You're interested in what has been abstracted by your game because it is a minis game. Whereas what I want is to you to go over to the thing you're interested in, abstract it a bit less, chuck the minis out the window, get a bit more deep into the thing that your game is actually about, and your game is actually sort of making fun and enjoyable for me, and maybe make that less abstracted, maybe put in something that pulls me more into that thing. It's like, if it is a monster chasing somebody, and like the really interesting bit is the little play of like the attack and the defense between the monster and the human being, maybe stick in a little something where the human has to like do something tension inducing to choose their attack. You know, flip a coin and catch it in midair, or just something to give me that a little moment of, oh, that was quite tense and I wasn't sure about that, and it was about me rather than just some dice or another abstracted thing. But you're not doing that, you're abstracting it with dice because you're tied to these minis to be the non-abstracted thing in your game. They are the thing that has to carry the physical meaning and the transferable skills to the players. And they are not the thing that your game is about. So you're putting the transferable skills, the human connection, into a bit of the game, which is the wrong bit of the game to be putting the people into. Put them into the thing that the game is about. That possibly is a way of sort of kind of what I meant about that, you know, that part of the set of ideas. And so,
right, so like definite clues that you're making a not miniatures game are, you know, as you move towards abstracting the position of miniatures, if you move towards the abstraction of the relationships, if, you know, you can sort of death by a thousand cuts this to a degree where you can be like, well, you know, what if ranges are sort of don't matter and everything's kind of got infinite ranges? And what if everyone's got a 360 degree line of fire? And what if it doesn't really matter if you get around behind someone? And you add all of these what ifs together and you end up with something where you've essentially abstracted all of the interesting sort of physical relationship guts of why you would bother using models in 3D space. And you've ended up something with that, you know, at the very least could be on gridded stuff, but probably could just be a card game because actually it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, and I think sometimes, like, looking to the cinematography of things in a weird way can be kind of beneficial. Like, I was watching a video about the Crimes of Grindelwald, the Fantastic Beasts sequel. And there's a duel in that where two people are dueling by basically pointing wands at each other, and fire comes out of it, meets in the middle, and then the fire moves sort of back and forth between them. And nothing's really physically happening on screen, because presumably the whole fight is like a very internalized sort of abstracted process of, I'm straining my magic muscle. God, I've got to like outwit his spell, which you don't represent on the screen. It doesn't happen physically on the screen. And so it's a terrible climax for a movie. And if you realize, if you're like, oh, I want to make this game that's like about a wizard's duel, and what happens is two wizards look at each other and then a bunch of stuff happens in their head. Maybe not a minis game, because the stuff that happens in their head, you're going to represent that with some sort of like board where there are like places and an area control thing. And this
and it'll look like a Euro, and there'll be little tokens of different power levels moving around, and you'll be placing your workers for which spell mana, you know, which channel of the wand it's going down.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like you don't want to make a Harry Potter Wizards Duel miniatures game, you know, between two people, because it's just, well, they both look at each other and then completely throw the tabletop out and go off to an abstracted board and figure out whatever the rules are of casting a spell are in the Harry Potter universe. And that's the actual game. And the minis are just an irritant.
I can't remember which book it is. I think it's one of the Ravenna books, one of the 40k Ravenna books, where two characters having a psychic duel essentially results in them like flying over the city and like smashing through all kinds of different things in a sort of superhero fight. Like, that's super physical. It's like really, you know, it's got all kinds of like obstacles and they possess other people, and it's really like, you know, you can imagine that as a miniatures game because it has all of the things that you need about, you know, occluded movement and whether I can see people at a certain moment and how far I throw them and now what's the range between us. And
I think it's like there are a couple of games that are a bit like this, the one-to-one scale games, and I think it's like if you were doing a superhero sort of minis game, it would work best, I think, as a one-to-one scale game where the dudes are literally fighting around your house and throwing each other through shelves and, you know, smashing each other through your fridge, because you need that much space for a proper superhero fight where someone's flying over a city. And I think, like, relating this back to a possibly you know, topical thing within miniatures gaming and something that has played Warhammer Fantasy Battle is like the Hero Hammer problem. And like Hero Hammer, particularly back in third and fourth edition Warhammer Fantasy Battle, the main problem with it was the flying high rule, where a hero on a flying monster could take off completely off of the battlefield into this entirely abstracted location. And if you had two people doing that, they could fight a duel in this totally abstracted location.
You say totally abstracted. It was always on top of a hill next to the other guy so that they could take a photo of it for the battle report.
I had a friend who had a blue painted shelf specifically right. for it. So they both went off onto the blue painted shelf and sat there. But the point is they
violate the spatial relationship at that point.
Absolutely. It's in this thing. And when Hero Hammer was like at its peak, the whole game was these two dudes sitting in an abstracted physical relationship, rolling dice at each other, and then one of them coming down and just annihilating the entire table. And movement didn't matter because he just flew around and he ate through units like they weren't even there. And that's an instance where, like, that fourth edition Warhammer Fantasy Battle should probably not have been a minis game. It should have just been a Hero Hammer card game, and whoever wins like the Hero Hammer card game, now that hero obviously devastates the battlefield. We won't make you go through the rigmarole of driving your dragon across a battlefield. But at the same time,
you know, that was an era of Warhammer that had, you know, estimating ranges, you know, no pre-measuring, estimating charge distances.
Well, it was, yeah, but not if you were flying high. Because if you were flying high, you just landed directly into combat you picked. And it was always the weird thing about, like, 4th and 5th edition. It was sort of like the two psychopaths took off, and then you had a fairly good game of Warhammer Fantasy Battle.
Quick, let's have a war game before they get finished.
Yeah, on the tabletop. It's these two lunatics just bad each other out. And then you're like, oh, wow. If not for those two guys, it looks like you would have won this actual game of Warhammer Fantasy Battle that we're having. But unfortunately for you, rage. that solved that problem.
Right. So I think you mentioned a phrase a moment ago, which I think perhaps transfers us to the next part of this conversation. So you mentioned transferable skills, and obviously the mastery of spatial relationships, spoilers, is going to be key to what the transferable skills are. But I think we can continue this dissection of when should something be a miniatures game and how might I tell in a subsequent part of this conversation. So for now, I think
that seems like a good place to take a quick break.
Tell us a little bit about how you feel the sort of, like, what do players of these games build up? And then what is it that I'm probably asking you to build up if I'm making a successful miniatures game? And if I'm heading off in the wrong direction, what am I then sort of focusing on?
Yeah, so people want to get better at a game that they are playing. I think that's a fairly natural thing. You know, people want to not be that great at it and then get better and better and better at it as time goes on.
Right. And we can say, like, there's some exceptions, like a one-armed bandit slot machine that sort of vaguely qualifies as a game. And there are some obviously bad games like Tic-Tac-Toe, which don't permit it, but, like, that's fine. They're obviously bad, but, like, on the whole.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, Tic-Tac-Toe permitting it is largely dependent upon your age. There are small children who get slowly better at tic-tac-toe, you know.
Right, for an adult player, it's a...
And I do think that there is a thing here about, like, the weight of a given game, that there are certain games that have a low ceiling intentionally because it's more welcoming to people, and there are games that are much, much heavier. But, and this is one, I guess, it's a bit like, whether it's about the size of the learning loop or whether it's about intrinsic and extrinsic skills, I'm not exactly sure the best way to word it, but a thing that is unusual, not unique, but unusual to these games is that you tend to come to the game with a thing you have, like, built or written an army list, something of that nature, which is an expression of the skills you have built up about the game and will significantly impact the probability of you winning that game in a way that board games and card games, as a rule, absolutely do not allow you to do. If you're playing, I don't know, let's say chess, how good you are going to get at chess is dependent upon you playing some chess.
Not dependent on your chess list building skills.
Yeah, absolutely. You're gonna need to play some chess. You're gonna need to learn some chess. The rules and, you know, the sort of heuristic abilities you're going to build up are going to be acquired at the chess board. And professional chess players, obviously that's not actually true. They're gonna sit down and study a book. But in something that isn't chess, if I'm playing, I don't know, Carcassonne, I'm not going to go away and study a how to play Carcassonne book and read through the Carcassonne games of Carcassonne masters. I'm going to learn to get better at Carcassonne by playing Carcassonne repeatedly against other people. Whereas if I'm playing a minis game, the loop of my getting better at the game is something along the lines of I play a game, I maybe make some piloting errors that are these sorts of things I learn about in the way that I will learn to be better at, say, Carcassonne. But I also learn some errors about my list building process. And I will go away into this sort of larger loop of learning the game, where I'll go off and I'll go back to the army book and I really suffered against his heavy artillery. What are some things that can, oh, there, I've got some flying skirmishers, I've got some fast cavalry, oh, I've got my own artillery, I'll try out one of these things. What do I take out to try that out? And I come back to the tabletop and I retest, and I'm building two different sorts of skill sets when I do that. One of them does belong to like board games. It's this at the tabletop piloting thing of the at the table game. The other one is a different, possibly extrinsic thing. Whether it's just a bigger loop and you've just got like, you know, a wheel within a wheel, or whether it's a genuinely sort of, you know, like if you're playing an RPG computer game, you can get better at dodging monsters and whacking them, which is like your intrinsic skill learning, or you can get better gear that like causes more damage when you hit them. That's like an extrinsic powering up of your character. And I think sometimes of list building as being an almost, it's not, but it's kind of like the extrinsic loop of getting better gear, and the piloting being like the little intrinsic thing of being better at like making your hack and slash guy dodge around with that gear when he's hitting them.
Okay, so I guess where I want to challenge that then is it feels to me like that's simply describing a metagame loop, and that we could describe that metagame loop for, you know, clutches of different kinds of games. You know, whether that's me endlessly reading wikis about the video game I'm playing because I can't really figure out how to beat the particular section of the game without learning better builds for my character or something, or if that's me, like, maybe Carcassonne is a dodgy example, but like maybe that's me like reading some people's like threads about, you know, what are some of the tricks and that you use to win at Carcassonne more regularly, and people telling you about, you know, their sort of things that they've learned and experimented with. It feels like that is basically describing like there is a meta game that carries on and that I get better over the course of external sort of stimulus, external research, external experimentation.
I think that the difference there is that the metagame you can choose to engage in with reading Carcassonne strategy wikis is not a metagame that everybody who plays Carcassonne engages with. The metagame of writing an army list, getting together units, is a metagame that everybody who plays Warhammer Fantasy Battle engages with at least once. You might do it once and just make a terrible list and never develop it, but you've had to go through that meta at least once in a way that people playing Carcassonne never have to have. And almost certainly the first time anybody plays Carcassonne, they will not have gone, you would be a weird person to, before your first ever game of Carcassonne, sit down and read a Carcassonne strategy guide. You could not sit down and go for an army list you know, before your first game of Warhammer Fantasy Battle, it's physically impossible unless you get some.
Right, but okay. So then my second sort of line of inquiry here is, well, if what we're saying is like, when should something be a miniatures game? Well, it should be a miniatures game if you provide, perhaps the negation is more useful here. Like, if you're providing something that has no like list building or metagame component, you're probably not making a miniatures game. And that to me doesn't sound right, because I can imagine it's not very common right now, and that I think is worthy of note. But like, I can imagine a game where we both just get five dudes and they're exactly the same, and we resolve this at the table.
No, yeah, it's not an absolute. It's an absolute in one way. If you want to have somebody doing some list building, then you almost certainly need to make a miniatures game. There's like, it's that or a TCG, you know. Otherwise, you're going to be making an absolute unicorn of a game. So if you want that, if you want to give people, you know, if you want the solo sort of larger wheel to be the normalized process of playing your game, rather than a place in which, like, weirdo specialists, you know, like pro Carcassonne players, the very fact of saying that seems insane and bizarre, you know.
Okay, but that's useful, because by providing the mini games or TCG, that actually really helps me understand, because it's like, well, because each time I tripped over this, I was like, well, yeah, but you would do this in Magic, or you would do this in Arkham Horror, and the answer is yes, and that's the other place that you would do this, but think of a third.
Yeah, it's a weird thing to ask people to do, and we accept it for deck building, and it's deck building, whether it's TCG, whether
you
it's
mean deck construction, so as not to be confused with,
well, opinion. Yes, because deck building games have, you know, sort of just stolen the term, and now it's had to be retcons to be deck construction. But yes, deck construction games and army list sort of writing games are the two widely accepted places where doing a crap ton of homework before your first game is like a fairly accepted thing to think about.
Now, are we demonstrating our lack of understanding of like hardcore D&D playing here? Like, is there also a third place here, which is if you are a fairly, like, what do I want to say, like, a mechanically interested, like a tactically minded role-playing player, you might be investigating a system and thinking about your upgrade tree. And
again I think that falls into the crowd of like, once you have developed into a certain sort of player, having played these certain sort of games a lot, it's like, you know, I'm sure there are like people who, when they're buying their Euro games, do a little bit of a study on like the strategies of that particular Euro game, so they can judge whether it's going to be the right flavor of piquancy for their particular tabletop. But I don't think anybody, the first time that they played one of those games, and I do not think it is inherent to the way that those games have to be approached. And it's like, yeah, a gamer could approach practically any game with this sort of meta sort of way of playing it. And I think it's significant that if you turn up to like a random RPG group and are like, I am a full-on min-maxing power gaming munch, I studied this game, like every bit of it, I've definitely read the Dungeon Master's handbook.
Right. And the tolerance for you turning up and doing that for 40k would be much higher. It would be much more like within the culture of the game, more normalized.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. If you turn up at like a Malifaux game,
yeah. No, I wasn't dissing 40k specifically there.
No. I just mean like in 40k, you may or may not have read the other person's codex. If you turn up to Malifaux, you've read the other person's, you know, list.
You've fallen asleep with your head in the latest book.
You have studied the other person's list. So the idea of you not doing it would be like, oh well, this is going to be lambs to the slaughter. Whereas if you roll up to like a random RPG session, you're like, oh, I know all the stats of that particular monster because I've memorized them. People are a bit like, I'd rather you didn't do that, mate. You
know? So to loop back to the beginning here, like my sort of concept of this is that, given that we, given that we're in a space where we are accepting of a vast array of physical objects in lots of different positions, we need complex rules. And as players, we've broadly accepted that. That sort of feels now to me similar to saying, well, I would like an incredibly vast, varied card pool for a TCG where there is a ton of design space for people to basically invent cards forever. And so I'm going to accept a fairly high floor of complexity, because without that floor, there's not enough design space to create 85,000 cards and constantly refresh the strategic pool. So this tolerance to complexity or breadth, it affords us as games designers this opportunity to provide depth that leads to the reward of kind of, you know, building up heuristics, getting mastery over time, and ultimately holding players' interest for a long time. And so if you are coming to a game design with a specific idea, which is, you know what, I've really got an idea about like how over like, you know, 36 games, the players will learn to navigate the complexity of my system, and they will begin to see the subtleties in the interactions, then great, the signs are okay that you potentially have a miniatures game here.
Yeah, whereas if you're building a game that you want someone to open the box, and maybe nobody has read the rules before opening the box, and play the game at the tabletop, and then put it back in the box and put it back on the shelf and not think about it again until they play next, all of which are perfectly sort of beneficial things. If you're trying to build something that's like fast and hitty and one shot and a party game to some degree, something that involves a lot of people, you know, in a sort of beer and pretzelsy way, maybe a minis game isn't going to be super beneficial to you. Maybe you want to sort of look at a board game and a box game. Maybe you want to pull out the fireworks factory from your minis game and stick it into a box. And that way you can go player count 6 to 10. Yeah, crack on, have fun with it in a way that you can't with a minis game to some degree.
Right. And perhaps even more so to say, if you are going to put miniatures and, you know, infinite analog positions of those miniatures, you kind of drag in a bunch of complexity about measurement and about line of sight that maybe your game would be better without dragging that baggage in.
And if you are dragging that baggage in, you may as well go in and go like, look, you're going to have to study this at some point on your own in a corner. I'll give you something fun to do while you're doing it. Write an army list. And I'm going to make you like buy minis and paint minis and assemble minis, so you're going to be living with this game when it is in the box. I may as well make that into a gamified process for you, rather than going, no, everything's decided at the tabletop, so the assembling and painting of minis is non-gamified. It's hobbified, but it's not gamified, and there's a sort of disconnect in the loop. So sometimes I think it's an emergent thing where it's like, well, we've got to be doing these things, we may as well gamify them.
Right, which I think is going back to X-Wing, the miniatures game. Like, I think, you know, line of sight with the sort of triangular things on the bases, that wasn't the perfect expression of like, they dragged in the baggage of movement, but they solved it with templates. They dragged in the baggage of line of sight, but they at least had square bases, and they did put really obvious lines on it, and you had a stick, so you could just, but like, I still see people struggling with line of sight routinely in X-Wing games. I think that's one of the most complicated part of it. And then it's got all this kind of card-based list building, but they did drag in a bit, but they tried to solve that in order to make it approachable for Christmas morning people.
Yeah, and it's significant that they don't make you paint your X-Wing minis, and you just grab a bunch of cards. You don't have to study a book. And it's, so it's like they've sort of gone, okay, well, we're trying to do this thing. This is how we will solve the other thing. They cared to solve the hobby loop for you, given that they're trying to make you an unbox at the tabletop miniatures game. And I think that in another way suggests, like, if you are trying to make the other sort of thing and make it a minis game, consider how you're going to solve the problem of the way that minis games sprawl out into people's other life.
Yeah, and I think this is just maybe the last bullet point on this conversation, which is, A lot of card games and board games provide either no configurable, like no player configurable setup state, or maybe they deal you a faction and you have to deal with that. But like this complexity that permits depth also provides this like breadth of starting positions that you can give to the players. And then, as you've been saying, like you then specifically give it to the players and you say, well, actually, there isn't a way of just opening the box and playing it. You have to do some homework. And I don't know, like most box games, I'm trying to figure it, like to go back to when should something be a miniatures game? Like, is it the case that if you aren't providing this, you aren't making a miniatures game? I don't think it is. It's just if you're trying to achieve that sort of very varied starting position,
Well,
then
again.
a game that can afford you the depth of rules that would allow you to provide a great panoply of that, like this is a good place to do it.
Yeah, and I think I'll sort of round off by saying some people, I know people who believe that the defining feature of these games is list building. That they think like this is one of the top three things that defines one of these games. You have to have list building in one of these games, which I don't think is true. I understand where it's coming from, but if you really want to make a list building game, if there's a lot of richness and interest in the list building in your game, yes, make a minis game. If you don't want to make a list building game at all, maybe you can give people a set of minis in a box, and maybe once you've got a box, the other things you're going to put in it might be a board that's got a grid on it, and you'll save yourself a lot of headaches. And I think these are more a sort of process thing where it's like, well, what do you want to do? What's going to get in the way of that? And what will the alternative solution afford you to make a quicker, faster, funner game than the one you might have been planning to make in the first place? And I think on that, we'll round up this particular conversation. Again, look, if you're working through some of these ideas for yourself, if you've got prototype ideas, you've got fledgling concepts, drop down into the comment section, tell us about them, tell us where you're going on the journey, whether you're considering different ways of doing it, or if we've made you think, oh, maybe my minis game isn't a minis game, drop down in the comment section and tell us that. Hit the like and subscribe while you're down there, and then take a little look at the links. In the links, there's our Discord where you can go over and have this conversation with other people, and there's Mike's Patreon where you can swing by and throw money at him for giving you the benefit of this splendid wisdom that he is handing out to us here. But for now, and from this conversation and from this episode of Rule of Carnage, I think we'll say a thank you and goodbye. So, thank you and goodbye.
Thanks, Glenn. Bye.
Thank you. Bye bye.